I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's April 11th, and we have a lot to talk about. And a quick scan of popular social media platforms reveals that a lot of people living with MS are interested in talking about the impact of diet on multiple sclerosis. So today, Dr. Ilana Katz-Sand, the Associate Director of Mount Sinai's Corinne Goldsmith Dickinson Center for Multiple Sclerosis, is back with an update for us on what the latest research is revealing about diet and MS, and to answer that eternal question. Is there a so-called MS diet? As researchers continue to learn more about the impact of diet on the gut microbiome and the gut microbiome's impact on our immune system, I think the answer to that question may be evolving. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Katz-Sand, there are a few other things that you should know about. Almost 2 years ago, we heard the announcement of a groundbreaking clinical trial for progressive MS called OCTOPUS. In this trial, researchers will be testing several existing drugs to determine whether they can be repurposed to help slow MS progression. This mega trial for progressive MS got its name, OCTOPUS, because the trial has multiple arms and multiple stages. The trial design allows for several drugs to be tried at the same time. Now, this type of trial design has been used before to test drugs for prostate cancer and COVID, but it's never been used in MS research. Interim analysis of MRI scans from each trial participant will allow the research team to move forward to the next stage in the trial much more quickly. If an MRI scan shows a particular treatment is slowing the rate of brain shrinkage, the research team can assume that will eventually slow disability worsening. And that particular treatment can be further investigated with hundreds of additional participants. Any treatments not showing potential in the MRI scan will be dropped from the study, so that researchers aren't wasting time and resources on treatments that are unlikely to be successful. Among many other things, the research team has spent the past 2 years determining which drugs to test in this clinical trial. And from a list of 100 potential candidates, the first two medications to be tested will be high-dose metformin, which is a diabetes drug that will be tested to determine whether it may help regenerate myelin, and a version of high-dose alpha-lipoic acid, which is a food supplement that acts as an antioxidant and has already been approved in Germany for treating weakness, pain, numbness, or tingling in damaged nerves. OCTOPUS is a game changer. It has the potential to make MS clinical trials more efficient, and that means that better treatments get developed, tested, and approved faster. OCTOPUS is being funded by the UK MS Society, and recruitment for the first 375 trial participants is already underway, with the second stage of the trial bringing the participant total up to about 1,000. OCTOPUS will eventually expand to 30 sites around the UK, and if you're interested in taking part in the clinical trial, you can register your interest online through the UK MS Register, and you'll find that link in today's show notes. While we're talking about clinical trials that have the potential to be true game changers, I'd have to include the CELLO study on that short list. Last week, I had the opportunity to speak with this study's principal investigator, Dr. Erin Longbrake. So I'm going to step out of the way and let Dr. Longbrake herself explain this rather unique clinical trial. What if we could stop multiple sclerosis before it started? That's the question that researchers are attempting to answer in a national clinical trial called the CELLO study. Joining me today to share some information about this study is Dr. Erin Longbrake, Dr. Longbreak is the Director of Clinical Research in Neuroimmunology and an MS Specialist at Yale University, as well as the Principal Investigator in this very intriguing study. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Longbreak.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
This study explores a question that we often talk about on this podcast when we're talking about the value of, say, being able to identify the prodromal phase of MS. It's the idea that early intervention with a high-efficacy disease-modifying therapy before someone develops actual symptoms of MS might keep that person from ever developing those symptoms. I like to say that it's not a cure, but it would certainly feel like one. So tell me, what is CELLO all about?
Well, the question you asked is really the million-dollar question for us. And we know that at the time someone has their first clinical episode leading to a diagnosis of MS, it's pretty clear that the disease pathology, the immune problems leading to the disease have been active for some time already at that point. People already have a lot of brain lesions, and so it's no telling how long that has been underlying in their system. What we know about MS is that the earlier you treat it, the better off people are in the long term. And so that begs the question of, if we could treat it before that first clinical episode, could we prevent the disease altogether? And that's what we're trying to address with the CELLO study. More, we are using one of the MS medications in the trial. We're using ocrelizumab, or Ocrevus. And Ocrevus is a medication that acts very specifically on B cells, one very specific type of immune cell. And what we know with this medicine is that we delete them temporarily with the medicine, and they will come back over time. But when they come back, they don't look the same as when they were deleted. They are less inflammatory. And so what we're asking in this study is, would a short-term use, just three doses of Ocrevus, be enough to effectively reset the immune system if we gave it early enough in the disease course? I illustrate this as saying, let's try to redirect an avalanche by standing at the top of the mountain and redirect that first stone, as opposed to what we currently do with MS, which is trying to redirect it by standing halfway down the mountain when the avalanche is already coming at you. And so with CELLO study, we're trying to stand at the top of the mountain and redirect at that really early stage.
What does participating in this study entail? What's actually involved?
Well, to participate in the study, we're looking for people who have a condition called radiologically isolated syndrome. And this is a situation that comes up when people have an MRI of their brain for some unrelated reason. Usually, in my experience, it's because of trauma for like a motor vehicle accident, or maybe for headaches. And instead of what they were looking for, they instead see these lesions that look like MS that don't apparently have anything to do with the symptoms that the person was experiencing. We call this radiologically isolated syndrome. And for many, not all, but many, it's a preclinical form of multiple sclerosis. And so we're looking for people like that to enter the CELLO study. Perhaps relevant to your listeners, because radiologically isolated syndrome is a very rare thing to discover, we are actually going and looking for it in the study. And so we are offering opportunities for people who are close family members of someone who's living with MS to be screened for the study. To decide if they'd want to participate, they would have to ask themselves, well, would I want to know if I had lesions? And if they would want to know, would I want to do something about it? Would I want to participate in a research study trying to prevent MS? And so people who answer yes to those two questions, who are a close family member of someone living with MS, may be eligible to be screened for the study.
Now, does someone have to live reasonably close to Yale in order to participate in this study?
Great question. CELLO is a national study. So we will have approximately 20 sites nationwide. About half of them are up and running right now, and we hope to have the other half up and running over the next few months. No, you don't have to live close to Yale. You might want to live close to at least one of our sites, though.
Well, where can people find out more about the study and perhaps take the next step toward becoming a study participant?
We have a great patient-facing website. It's www.cellostudy.org. And cello is spelled like the musical instrument. So it's cellostudy.org. People can go to that site and find all kinds of information about what the study entails, what kinds of things we're looking for in the study, and also find the list of sites and contact information for each site. So that's their best next step, to see all about the cello study.
That's great. And I'll be sure to include a link to that website in today's show notes. Dr. Longbreak, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. Best of luck in this study. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's hardly news that smoking is bad for everyone's health. And it's particularly bad for people living with MS. Research has shown that people with MS who smoke experience a more severe disease course and faster disease progression. They show greater lesion activity on their MRI scans, they experience higher rates of brain atrophy, and they often experience more fatigue, depression, and an overall worse quality of life. That seems like a lot to lose. And newly published results from a study in Sweden provide even more evidence that if you're living with MS and you're smoking, you're choosing to harm yourself. The research team wanted to explore associations between snuff and MS progression. Snuff is a smokeless tobacco that you use by placing it between your upper lip and your gum. The researchers also wanted to investigate how exposure to secondhand smoke, called passive smoking, and quitting smoking affected disease outcomes. The study included data from 9,089 people living with MS who were followed in two population-based studies in Sweden, as well as disability data from the Swedish MS Registry. The mean age of the study participants was 37.6 years, and 72% of the study participants were women. The study participants were grouped into one of three categories based upon their smoking habits at the time of their MS diagnosis. 40.4% of the participants were classified as never smokers, 31.9% were classified as current smokers, and 27.7% were classified as past smokers. Now let me share some sobering observations that the research team was able to make. At the time of their very first disability assessment following their MS diagnosis, smokers had significantly higher EDSS scores and worse cognitive function than non-smokers. Compared with never smokers, both current smokers and past smokers became more disabled faster. Current smokers were 13% more likely than never smokers to experience confirmed disability worsening, and were 31% more likely to reach an EDSS score of 4, which indicates severe disability. Interestingly, past smokers showed no association with these negative outcomes, which represents one more very good reason to stop smoking if you already haven't. 61% of the study participants reported past daily exposure to secondhand smoke, and about 21% of the study participants reported current daily exposure to secondhand smoke. Both of these groups experienced faster disability progression, with those study participants who reported current exposure to secondhand smoke at an 18% higher risk of confirmed disability worsening compared to those study participants who reported past exposure to secondhand smoke. The study results among snuff users were interesting and perhaps unexpected. 1,097 study participants reported that they were currently using snuff, and 447 participants indicated that they had used snuff in the past. Both current and past snuff users had a 16% lower risk of confirmed disability worsening, and a 19% lower risk of reaching an EDSS score of 4 compared to study participants who had never used snuff. Snuff was also associated with less disability and better cognitive function at the time of initial disability assessment. So while snuff seemed to have a positive impact on MS disease progression, You'll probably want to factor in the Centers for Disease Control warnings that snuff can cause gum disease, tooth decay, gum loss, and can even cause these white or gray patches in your mouth that can lead to cancer. Well, I'm not sure what more needs to be said about the negative impact of smoking on MS. The good news here is that smoking is a modifiable risk factor. The choice to quit smoking is not an easy one, but the consequence of not quitting seems to be far worse. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Obesity has been identified as one of the comorbidities or other health conditions that may also make MS symptoms more severe, trigger more frequent relapses, and accelerate progression. So while we're talking about modifiable risk factors that can make a real difference in the quality of your MS journey, we should include diet in that conversation. And in a moment, we'll get an update on what the latest research on diet and MS is telling us when we meet my guest, Dr. Ilana Katz-Sand. Today we're talking about what my listeners have told me is one of the top three topics of interest among people living with MS. We're talking about diet, nutrition, and their relationship to multiple sclerosis. And joining me once again as we dive into this subject is Dr. Ilana Katz-Sand. Dr. Katz-Sand is the Associate Director of Mount Sinai's Corinne Goldsmith Dickinson Center for Multiple Sclerosis and an Associate Professor of Neurology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Katz-Sand.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's great to be here.
I hope you'll start us off by explaining the difference between diet and nutrition.
Sure. So people have different interpretations of these words, and I think sometimes people use them interchangeably. But if we're going to really drill down into it, I would say that diet generally refers to the foods that you eat on a regular basis, and nutrition refers to the nutrients that you provide for your body as a result of that dietary intake.
I think people understand how our food choices might impact our weight, for instance, but it really doesn't stop there. How do the foods we eat impact our overall health?
Yeah, so that's a really good point. I think about foods as impacting our health directly and indirectly. So the indirect part is what you mentioned in terms of something like weight. And of course, that goes along with other medical conditions like cholesterol and diabetes and high blood pressure. And we have good research at this point showing that those conditions has an increased risk of having worse MS. And so it's important to think about the link for diet there, right? Because obviously diet can help us in terms of preventing those conditions and managing them. But the one that I think is really even more interesting is the direct part of things. And thinking about the food that we take into our bodies gets broken down into metabolites. And I think we should think about those metabolites in the same way that we think about our pharmacologic interventions, right? When we use the oral route for medications, we're just taking advantage of a process that's already there to help us digest our food, right? And so we should think about our diets as having the ability to have a lot of different actions throughout the body. So those metabolites that come from your diet, they act locally in the gut, but they also are able to act on all organs throughout the body. That includes the brain, and they can really have a big impact on our health.
On this podcast, we've often talked about the interest among researchers in exploring the connection between the gut and MS. Can you walk us through the connection between gut health, inflammation, and multiple sclerosis?
Sure. So as we mentioned, the food that we eat gets digested into metabolites, and that happens in our intestine by our intestinal cells, but part of what enables us to really digest those foods and extract the nutrients are our gut microbiota, which is a collective term for the bacteria that live in our gut. We have trillions of bacteria in our gut. And which bacteria are there, as well as which metabolites the bacteria produce, are really heavily impacted by the foods that we eat. The dietary components and the microbiota interact really heavily with the local immune system in the gut, which is huge. So something that a lot of people don't realize is that 70% of our body's immune system lives inside the gut. So the interactions that happen there are really important in terms of determining our overall balance in the body between pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory. So when immune cells are born in the gut, they can become pro-inflammatory or anti-inflammatory. They can produce pro-inflammatory molecules or anti-inflammatory molecules. And part of what is going to coax them to become one or the other is going to be the intake of our diet and the bacteria that are living there and the metabolites that they produce. Then these cells and the molecules that the immune system then produces to communicate with other organs diffuse throughout the body, including to the central nervous system. And that's where a relationship to MS really comes into play.
I have a sort of two-sided question for you. Can diet and nutrition prevent or reduce MS symptoms? And I'll also ask you the flip side of that same question. Can diet and nutrition perhaps exacerbate MS symptoms?
Yeah, I think those are two sides of one coin. And the way that I think about all of this is we eat, right? So we're going to eat. And so I think that we should be, as clinicians, thinking about this as an opportunity for us to advise our patients to be able to do something that's going to help them rather than to harm them. Right. So if we think about diet in those two ways that we were just talking about in terms of thinking about the ability to prevent and help manage some of those cardiometabolic conditions like diabetes, hypertension, I think it's really important there. And then it's really important from the direct pathway. And so I would say, yes, when we think about the research that's been done so far, I think diet can definitely help with MS symptoms. The studies have been small at this point, but almost every published study on this topic, and people have looked at different patterns, but all of them have showed a benefit in terms of managing MS symptoms like fatigue. The prevention side of it, I think, is a little bit harder to prove, but we do have some observational studies at this point that lead us to believe that certain dietary habits are probably better than others in terms of their relationship to MS outcomes. And so, yes, I would say that that means that having a more optimal dietary pattern is probably better in terms of reducing MS symptoms and preventing MS from getting worse over time. That's the direction that the research is going, although we have a lot more work to do still.
What does a healthy or a balanced diet actually look like?
So a healthy diet doesn't have to look the same for everyone, and it's not going to, right? Everyone is different. But there are a few guiding principles that most clinicians are going to agree on. So I'm very lucky to be part of a wonderful group called the National MS Society's Wellness Research Working Group, and we have a nutrition subcommittee, and it's made up of really fantastic clinicians and researchers who are all really interested in advancing the research on this topic and getting answers for people who are living with MS. And so we are all researching different dietary patterns and different ideas, but we came together as a group and we put together some recommendations that we think are reasonable to recommend right now for people who are living with MS. And those recommendations are posted on the National MS Society website, and I would encourage you to take a look there. But just kind of briefly, we recommend things like preparing meals at home when you're able to, limiting your intake of processed foods, incorporating fresh fruits and vegetables, and those can be, you know, fresh or they can also be frozen as long as they're not highly processed, and then choosing whole grains rather than refined grains if you choose to eat grains. So those, I think, are some recommendations that everyone can agree on and that we think are healthy and are helpful.
One of the reasons I'm always happy to have you on to talk about this subject is I know you and your team are involved in actively researching the interaction between diet, nutrition, and MS, and I'm looking forward to getting into what you're learning. You've led research looking at the link between dietary factors and brain structure in multiple sclerosis. What has that research shown?
So I think you're referring to the first observational study that we did to help us look at Mediterranean patterns. And so that was in our RADIUMS cohort. RADIUMS stands for Reserve Against Disability in Early MS. And our cohort is made up of 185 people with MS who graciously volunteered to be part of the study soon after they were diagnosed. And the main objective of the study is to look to see what are the risk and protective factors for development of disability in MS. So our participants really nicely volunteered to provide us with a lot of information. And so we collected data on their health habits, their MS history, their medical history. We examined them clinically, and they all had research MRIs. We collected detailed dietary information, and that allowed us to calculate a score. The score that we used in that particular study is called a MIND score. MIND stands for Mediterranean Dash Intervention for Neurodegenerative Delay. And it's based on principles of foods that are hypothesized to be healthy for the brain versus maybe not so healthy for the brain. And that allows you to get a score of 0 to 15. So things like olive oil and nuts, berries, leafy green vegetables will get you more points. And then things like butter, sugar sweetened beverages and pastries will lower the score, basically. And so we were able to then calculate that score for all of our participants and then look to see how that associated with people's MRIs. And so the main finding of the study was to show an association between the MIND score and the volume of the thalamus. The thalamus is a deep gray matter structure in the brain. And it's actually been shown to be the earliest structure involved in people with MS in terms of loss of tissue, which is, you know, loss of nerve cells and loss of volume. So the fact that we were able to see in people who were really early in their MS disease course, on average, our participants were only 2 years from diagnosis. We were able to see that those who had a higher MIND score had a better thalamic volume. That was really interesting to us because it implies that perhaps following a pattern that aligns with a Mediterranean pattern may be somewhat protective. I do want to emphasize it's an observational study and it's a single time point. We are going to be looking at the impact of these factors on people over time as the study progresses, but we did find this to be really interesting and something that definitely warrants more work to be done going forward.
So here's a question I have to ask you. It's the question that's most often debated in online forums, I'll say for better or worse. What does recent research suggest about a quote unquote best diet for MS?
Yeah, this is a great question. It's definitely a hotly debated topic. It's something that people ask me all the time and they really want me to tell them, you know, what is the best, you know, what is the best one? We know there's many patterns out there. We've made a lot of progress from a research standpoint, but I wouldn't say that we're at a point where we can say for sure, oh, this particular pattern is the best one. I think we also have to be open to the idea that there may very well be more than one dietary pattern that's very good for people with MS. And so, you know, perhaps what we're going to end up encouraging people to do is to choose a pattern that speaks to them in terms of their own preferences and current habits, as long as it's one that follows some of these general guidelines. I think we also have to think about the fact that there may be personalized factors that we have to take into account when we make these recommendations. And that's something that's going to take a lot more research to figure out. The thing I think we can feel confident in terms of recommendations for people who are living with MS, because of course people are living with this right now and they can't wait for us to figure all this out in research. I think we can feel confident about the recommendations that we just discussed that come from the National MS Society's Wellness Research Working Group. I think more and more research is pointing us to the importance of just following these general healthy eating principles. And that's for everyone, but really particularly when you have MS.
Has a relationship been found between diet, nutrition, and MS disease course?
Yes, I will say that it has. It's something that we are studying in RADIUMS over time, but As I mentioned, the group that we started evaluating were very early on in their disease course, and so we couldn't really study it in that population. So in order to look at this, we actually performed a study using a different population, which is our patients who have come through our comprehensive annual assessment program, which we are very fortunate to have here at Sinai. It's run through our neuropsychology clinic and directed by my fantastic colleague, Dr. Samowski. So when people come through our clinic, they complete surveys about their health habits, which includes a dietary screener. And that allows us to calculate a Mediterranean diet score, which is similar to the MIND score in terms of which foods it emphasizes or de-emphasizes. They also complete questionnaires about their MS symptoms, and people undergo physical testing, cognitive testing. So it allows us to get a really nice comprehensive look at both people's health habits and just how they're doing in terms of their MS. And so it's a wonderful program clinically. I think it's really helpful for clinicians, and our patients really like it, but it also allows us to do some really great research looking at associations between these things. And so we recently published a study regarding the relationship that we found between Mediterranean diet score and MS-related disability. We used a composite measure, which is called the Multiple Sclerosis Functional Composite. Some people may be familiar with it because it's often used in MS research and clinical trials. And it includes three tests. One is a test of walking speed, one is a test of hand function, and one is a cognitive test. And we found a strong relationship between having a better Mediterranean diet score and having a better multiple sclerosis functional composite score. And I think what's really important about the way we conducted this study, which again, we were very fortunate to be able to do because we have so much information collected from people, is that we were able to control for all the factors that we may think of that that might otherwise explain this relationship that we saw, right? So of course, diet is also going to be related to a lot of other things, right? We were able to control for things like age, sex, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, which Dr. Samowski did a great job of coming up with an index to really help us control for this factor, which is really important. Body mass index, things like diabetes, high blood pressure, as well as people's other habits like exercise and smoking. And even after we controlled for all of those factors, we found that this relationship was still there and still strong. So that was pretty exciting to us. Definitely something that warrants a lot more research going forward. But I think we are slowly building on this idea that our dietary habits are really able to have a big impact on our health. And we think that they are having an impact in terms of MS disease course.
We've been talking about how good nutrition delivers real evidence-based benefits for people who are living with MS. We also know that distance to grocery stores, lack of transportation, and low income can prevent some members of underserved minority communities from obtaining fresh, healthy food. How do these systemic barriers impact people in those minority communities who are living with MS? And most importantly, what can they do about it?
Yeah, so I think you hit on a couple of really important points. You know, I think the first thing in here is to really be thoughtful as healthcare providers and to really recognize factors like systemic racism, which has led to historically marginalized groups being at higher risk of having medical conditions like obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, that can make chronic illnesses like MS worse and would really benefit from dietary intervention. And at the same time, because of some of these factors that you mentioned, people may have suboptimal access to primary care, decreased availability of high quality grocery stores in certain communities because of a long history of discriminatory housing practices. And there really are a lot of other inequalities in the system. And I think as healthcare providers, it's really important for us to be aware of those and to make sure that we're paying attention to these factors. I think it's really important to prioritize our patients who come from historically marginalized groups for services that we have available. And so, for example, at Mount Sinai, we have a really wonderful patient wellness program, and where we're really able to pay attention to these factors and to really help our patients with dealing with their overall wellness and incorporating these dietary recommendations. So I think that's kind of the first step, is for us healthcare providers to recognize that these factors exist, that they're really important, and to make sure that we're doing everything we can to address them. In terms of, you know, working toward being able to access healthy food, this is a topic that I am personally extremely passionate about. I believe very strongly that everyone should be able to have healthy food to eat every single day. And this is even more important for someone who's living with a chronic illness like MS. So I think the first part here is I really want to emphasize that food insecurity is a really common problem, and no one should feel that they're alone or should feel embarrassed about asking for help. This is just the unfortunate reality of the way systems are set up. And everyone sometimes is going to be the person who needs help. We all are going to reach a point in our lives where we're the person who needs the help. And no one should feel embarrassed about asking. There are so many programs and resources out there. All you have to do really is to raise your hand and ask. And I think there's a lot of people out there who can help. If you are savvy with the computer, I would definitely recommend checking to see about eligibility for government assistance programs. So the one that may be familiar to people is called SNAP, which is a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And it's a wonderful program. WIC is another one for pregnant and postpartum women and young children specifically. But these programs are doing a good job these days in terms of partnering with grocery stores and farmers markets and really working on improving people's access to healthy foods. I know that it can sound like a lot to figure out whether you're eligible and to sign up. Keep in mind that a lot of healthcare institutions will have an office that is dedicated to resource entitlement and advocacy that actually will have people who can help you sit down and help you sign up for these programs. And they can also direct you to more local resources that can be helpful. And in that same line, it's really important to talk to your healthcare provider. So to your MS doctor or to your primary care provider. Oftentimes there's going to be a social worker in the office or even a shared social worker for the institution who can really sit down with you and again, help you identify what are the local resources. So in New York City, we are unfortunately are in an area where there are high levels of food insecurity, but fortunately, we are also in a place that is really dedicated to working on this. And so there are a lot of programs out there. There are several large food banks that really focus on having fresh foods available and a lot of choices. There are community fridges. There are programs for people with limited mobility. For example, there's a program we use a lot here that we've been using quite a bit in our wellness program called God's Love We Deliver that will deliver healthy foods to people who are living with chronic illnesses, and all it needs is a referral from a healthcare provider. I think it's important to note that your healthcare team might not know that this is something that you're struggling with, and so it's important to tell them so that they can help. Additional resources, nutrition.gov is a great one. There's a topic there specifically dedicated to food security and access that can help you get started. And there's a section also with a lot of really nice tips about how to make the most of your grocery budget. That's also something that a dietitian can be really helpful with, although I recognize it's not always so easy to access that resource. And lastly, I would highly recommend, especially if you feel like it's harder for you to navigate some of these online signups and things, I would definitely reach out to one of the National MS Society's navigators, and they can definitely help you in terms of exploring additional community resources.
Dr. Ilana Katzand, I always appreciate your willingness to make time to update us on the latest research on diet, nutrition, and MS. I hope you'll come back and do it again. And thank
you. I would love to. Yeah.
And I will hold you to that. Thanks for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. Always great to be here.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/293. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.